welcome to another episode of Word Magazine, an occasional commentary from Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church here in Central Virginia. It is a Friday, February the 20th of 2015. It is a very cold, snow-covered day here in Central Virginia. Most things have just been shut down for the entire week, but that has meant being forced to be indoors and giving lots of opportunity to read and study and do some writing. So I've been able to redeem the time, and I've had a pretty enjoyable week spending time reading, studying, writing, etc. Well, I wanted to record a Word Magazine. I had not done one yet in the month of February, and I hated to have a month go by without doing something. And so I thought I would do something a little different today. I've been doing a lot on text criticism, and of course I'm still very interested in that, and there have actually been some interesting things that have happened in that whole field. I've read some interesting books recently. Continuing to do some writing and some studying on the topic. Was able yesterday to look at the Codex Vaticanus, which is now online. Pretty amazing that people in past generations have had to travel to Rome and get special permissions to see Codex Vaticanus, or purchase a very expensive facsimile, or go to a library that has one of these facsimiles. But now, by virtue of the click of a mouse, anyone can examine Codex Vaticanus. It's completely online from Genesis to Revelation, and it has apocryphal books in the Old Testament, which I did a post on the other day on my blog, jeffriddle.net, on the Old Testament books in Vaticanus. I'm saying all that about text criticism to say that I'm not going to do this Word Magazine on text criticism. Instead, I'm going to offer a review. I don't know if I can really call it a review, because it's not strictly a review. Just some reflections, responses to a book that I did not read during this snow-covered week. I actually read it a couple weeks ago. But the book is Stanley Hauerwas's memoir, which is titled Hannah's Child, A Theologian's Memoir, published by Erdmans in 2010. Some might not know who Stanley Hauerwas is. He is a theology professor, taught for a long time at Notre Dame, about 14 years, and then at Duke University in the Divinity School for about 25 years. I got a hold of this memoir. I'd seen it mentioned somewhere, and again, this isn't exactly new. It was published 5 years ago. This is not exactly breaking news, but I really have come to enjoy the genre of the memoir. I read a couple of memoirs last year, Ayan Hirsi Ali's two memoirs, Infidel, and the name of the second is escaping me right now. But anyways, I read her memoirs, and read several others, and just enjoy the genre. It's a kind of an interesting change of pace when you've been reading sort of things that you have to plod through that are valuable, but you have to plod through. Sort of more refreshing to read something like a memoir. And also is interested in it because Stanley Hauerwas obviously comes from a more liberal, definitely liberal, theological tradition. So he doesn't come from an evangelical Christian, conservative, or Calvinistic tradition. It's kind of interesting just to see what other people, how other people think through things. And of course, it's always interesting to hear the course of a person's life, what they've been through, and then to reflect on how their theology affects their life, and how their life affects their theology. So I sat down and read this memoir, and read it quickly, got it, ordered it used, and got it and read it in, I think, a day or two. It's pretty gripping to read somebody else's story. Stanley Hauerwas is a pretty interesting writer. But I thought I would offer, again, a review, reflection on this book. And I wrote up some notes, which I will post to my blog, jeffriddle.net. And if you want to read these in more detail, I'm basically just going to go through my notes and then just add some extra information here and there. Well, Stanley Hauerwas, I already told you a little bit about him to tell you a little bit more. He was, for some time, the Gilbert T. Rowe Professor of Theological Ethics at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, again in the Divinity School. He has apparently recently retired from that. Again, this was written 5 years ago, so I think he was 70 when the memoir was written. He would now be 75, but he's now retired. He is keen to point out that this book is not strictly an autobiography, but it is rather a memoir. He doesn't attempt a strict chronological account of his life, but he is offering various reflections on various aspects of his life. Stanley Hauerwas is one of the best-known modern academic American theologians. In the year 2001, Time magazine named him the best theologian in America, whatever that means. And that was back in the time when people were actually probably still reading the print version of Time. I'm not even sure if it exists as a print version any longer. But in 2001, he was called the best theologian in America. Hauerwas' memoir is compelling, very compelling on a personal level, particularly as he describes a very difficult first marriage that he had to a woman named Anne, who suffered from some very severe mental illness, and also provides some interesting insights, I think, into what it's like to be a mainline Protestant theologian, as Hauerwas is in this generation. And so there's a lot to learn from this book. I want to, if I can, offer a sketch of Hauerwas' life as it's presented in the memoir. And then after I do that, which will be the bulk of the time, I want to come back and just draw a few reflections on Hauerwas' theology and also on his ethics, particularly as it relates to how he handled this difficult marriage to this mentally unstable woman. So let's begin by just sketching Hauerwas' life as he presents it in this memoir. Hauerwas was born and raised in Pleasant Mound, Texas, and was actively involved from his childhood in the local Methodist church there, which was Pleasant Mound Methodist Church. Both of his parents were staunch, involved members at that church. Hauerwas was an only child. His parents had him a little later in life. And the memoir's title, Hannah's Child, his mother was not named Hannah, but it refers to the fact that his mother, before he was born, had made a sort of a pact with God, much as the biblical Hannah had done, that if God would grant her a son, she would dedicate him to the Lord's service. And so she told him about this years later, and it became meaningful to him, as it might be certainly to anyone. And so he has thought of himself as being like the biblical Samuel, one whose mother promised him to the Lord's service when he was even before he was conceived. Hauerwas had a rather difficult relationship with his mother. If you take it, the memoir at face value, seems to be very transparent in talking about that. His mother was an incessant talker and seemed to be someone who was needy for attention, who liked to be needed, and would make a fuss about doing things, even if she wasn't always asked to do them, because she wanted to be needed. He, though, can speak as well very tenderly about his mother, and And he has a section where he wrote to his grandsons a few pages, a letter about his mother, so they could understand better their, I guess, great-grandmother. And so there was sort of a bit of a love-hate relationship with his mother. With regard to his father, however, he seems to have nothing but admiration for him. His father was a quiet man who worked as a bricklayer and who was quite a craftsman at that skill. And he would take Hiawatha along when he was a very young child, 6 or 7 years old, to help him with his work. And after he grew older, then his father taught him some of the skills of bricklaying. And so Hiawatha looks back on that time very positively and believes in particular that his father conveyed to him a strong work ethic. And he says this is why he was able to produce so much academic writing, because he had learned from a young age a strong work ethic. And also, I think with the bricklaying, you know, to be careful, to be precise, to lay things out skillfully. It's quite an analogy for doing a theological type work. Hiawatha somewhat provocatively states that he was never saved or never became a Christian while he was at Pleasant Mound, although he was apparently baptized and went through confirmation there. But what he means by that is he never responded to an emotional or evangelistic altar call while he was at Pleasant Mound. But as a teenager, he did commit himself during some sort of meetings that were held there. He committed himself to full-time Christian service, although he didn't really know what that meant. Having done so, he went to a small Methodist-related school, Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas, where he was planning to prepare to go into some sort of Christian service. And while at this small Methodist school, he was influenced by a teacher there who was a graduate of Duke University, a man named John Score. And one of the things that the memoir is interesting at this part is just to indicate the influence that a teacher can have in the life of a student, an older person can have in the life of a younger person. And John Score had a big impact on Hiawatha's life. It was while in college that Hiawatha also became more acutely aware of his blue-collar background. He was the first person from his family to go to college, and he sort of rubbed shoulders at Southwestern with kids who had come from more privileged backgrounds, middle-class backgrounds, and family members who had previously gone to college, that sort of thing. And so he became, again, just more aware, I guess, of the class issues related to his own upbringing. He obviously had some strong academic and intellectual abilities, and he was encouraged, especially by his mentor, John Score, to go to Yale Divinity School in New Haven, Connecticut. So in 1962, at the age of 22, he enrolled at Yale. Again, he makes mention of the fact that when he went there, he was going to the divinity school, the professional school that prepares people for ministry. He really still was not sure he was a Christian. He really had not been a part of a church during his college days, but he sort of went in blindly into divinity school without really understanding what it was about. Yale in those days was going through a transition. Obviously, it was an elite academic school, but the H. Richard Niebuhr and Roland Bainton had just retired. But the school still had a number of distinguished, what we would call liberal or mainline Protestant scholars. and Hauerwas came under their influence, if not sort of personally, not being personal mentors, but through their writing and through their teaching. Among the persons with whom he studied or came under the influence were George Lindbeck, although he never had a course with him, Hans Frey, with whom he took a Christology class, Brevard Childs, who was just then developing his canonical criticism and so forth. He had Brevard Childs for one semester of Old Testament, and he had Walter Zimmerle for the second semester. That's quite a weighty couple of academic professors. He studied New Testament with Paul Meyer and ethics with James Gustafson. Intellectually, Hauerwas came under the influence in particular of through his writings, not directly, but through his writings and through the professors there who were influenced by him, came under the influence of the great neo-Orthodox theologian Karl Barth, and also was introduced to many other thinkers like the existentialist Soren Kierkegaard. He doesn't mention, when he discusses his sojourn in divinity school, contact with classical or Reformed theology, reading Calvin or Luther. And in fact, he seems almost entirely to have dealt with modern theology, Barthian-type theology. He was surprised, he writes, to learn that divinity students had to do some practical ministry. It was, after all, supposedly a professional school, and he had to work in a local church teaching Sunday school, something he did, and even though he still really didn't identify himself explicitly as a Christian. At the end of his first semester at Yale, he married a woman named Anne Harley, whom he had met and began to date in college. And she moved to New Haven and got a job, and they had their honeymoon there with him as a student at Yale. A few years later, in 1968, they have their first and only son, Adam. And according to Hauerwas, it was not long after the birth of Adam that he began, sadly, to notice increasingly erratic behavior from his wife, Anne, which was often particularly expressed in rage and frustration with him. And these things were a harbinger of severe mental and emotional problems that Anne was suffering under that were to come. After completing his master's degree, master divinity degree, he went on to do further graduate work at Yale, eventually completed a doctoral degree working under Gustafson in theological ethics. He finished the degree, and a few years later, in 1975, he published a version of his dissertation as a book titled Character and the Christian Life, which began to make a mark for him in academic circles. He was interested in sort of the classical understanding of virtue and how this applied to the Christian life. After completing his degree in 1969, Hauerwas began his teaching career at a small Lutheran college named Augustana in Rock Island, Illinois. And whereas Yale had been sort of at the center of a bustling academic life, Rock Island, Illinois was a little more out of the way, although Hauerwas was glad to have a job, and he enjoyed teaching. Although, as he describes in the memoir, he also began to run into some problems. It was the late 60s, and it was the beginning of sort of the radicalization of student life on college campuses, and he admits that as a 28-year-old teaching undergraduates, he was a bit cocky and brass, got into trouble in some faculty meetings by criticizing the school for not hiring minority faculty members, and He was told, though his teaching apparently was successful, that he would not have his teaching contract renewed there at Augustana, and so he knew that he needed to look elsewhere. And just then, there was an opening that he found out about at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. And so he made the transition from Rock Island, Illinois, to South Bend. Though Notre Dame, of course, is a Roman Catholic school, its religion department, particularly in those days, was very progressive and hired Protestants, even had a Jewish professor. And so they were glad to hire Howard Wass to come in and to teach theology and ethics. He would stay there for 14 years. And it was while at Notre Dame that his academic career would really begin to blossom. He began to write and to publish, including works in the field of medical ethics, especially on issues related to the mentally handicapped. And some of his work was noticed by the Kennedy family, and he spoke at some institutions and things and some events that were sponsored by the Kennedys in D.C. on the issue of dealing with the mentally handicapped. It was while at Notre Dame that Howard Wass also came into contact with the eccentric Mennonite theologian John Howard Yoder, who taught at nearby Goshen College and Seminary. And then through Howard Wass's friendship with Yoder, eventually Yoder came to teach at Notre Dame with him. Howard Wass will list John Howard Yoder as the theologian who most influenced his thinking. In particular, Howard Wass, under Yoder's influence, embraced during this time a pacifist position with regard to war and violence. And there's a lot about Howard Wass's story that's, I think, typical for people of his time. He's beginning his career in the late 60s, early 70s, the anti-Vietnam War movement. And so again, he sort of falls into this being against war, being a pacifist sort of position. It's while he's at Notre Dame that troubles at home, though there had been sparks of this when he had been at Augustana, but while he's at Notre Dame, troubles at home become much more intense. Anne experiences her first psychotic break, and she is committed for a short time to a psych ward in a hospital and begins to be placed under lithium and other medications. And so there begin to be real hardships in his home. The crisis at home sends Howard Wass looking for involvement in a church. He and Adam begin looking for a place to go to church. He starts off, as he says in his memoir, regularly attending a Roman Catholic chapel there at Notre Dame. I think in one of the dorms, one of the student housing places, he starts attending Mass and participates in it, although he doesn't seem to be aware of the fact that Roman Catholics do not allow those who are not Catholics, properly Catholics, to participate in the Eucharist, despite the fact that he has a divinity degree and he's a theology professor. He indicates that he wasn't really aware of the exclusiveness of the Roman Catholic Church. Eventually, he becomes involved, along with Adam, in a small Methodist church in South Bend, Broadway Methodist Church. Anne does not attend with them. She becomes very intensely antagonistic toward religion. She had religious parents and has a backlash against that, and has a backlash against Howard Wass liking theology and so forth. And so she doesn't attend, but he and his son do. And it's particularly at this Broadway Methodist church where the pastor, who is a divorcee, though he at least instills in Howard Wass, it seems, for the first time, some understanding of churchmanship. and why the church is important and why you ought to be part of a local church and why you ought to make a commitment to it, why you ought to attend, why you ought to serve, why you ought to know other Christians and so forth. And so he has kind of his conversion moment to the church there at Broadway Methodist in South Bend. Eventually, changes come to Notre Dame. When you get a memoir from an academic, part of what he's going to describe is academic politics. He describes a new department chairman who came on at Notre Dame, a man named Richard McBrien. And I remember when I took a course in my undergraduate career, we had to read parts of McBrien's book called Catholicism. He literally wrote the book on Catholicism, but McBrien was a progressive Catholic, very much a Vatican II type Catholic, but he wanted the department, the religion department at Notre Dame, to be more conscientiously Catholic, and this rubbed Howard Wass the wrong way, and so he began to look for a transition, for an exit to another place. And a door opened for him to go to the Divinity School at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina in 1983. So he got a prestigious appointment to become a professor there. Duke, by historic connections, is a Methodist church, started out as a United Methodist Church, although it doesn't have strong, I don't think, confessional ties with Methodism. Probably much any longer, like many schools, those were its roots. And so Howard Wass was poised by taking this appointment to become, I think, one of probably the leading Methodist public theologians. After all, he had grown up as a Methodist, and he had been part of a Methodist church in South Bend. He came to Duke about the same time as Will Williman, came to be the university chaplain there at Duke. And Williman was also a very hard worker, prolific author, and gifted speaker. And Howard Wass and Williman sort of hit it off. The two of them collaborated on a couple of books during that time, including one that had a big impact in sort of mainline Protestant churches. The book was titled Resident Aliens, published in 1989. It made a splash by attempting to coach mainline churches on how they need to come to terms with their more marginalized position in society and their loss of influence, and they ought to be more like pilgrims, resident aliens in this life rather than trying to be the ones in charge. Some of his fellow liberal theologians, like his former mentor, Gustafson and Jeffrey Stout at Princeton and others, accused Howard Wass and Williman, however, of becoming sectarian and being tribalists, but they pursued this particular attack of sort of a friendly critique of the mainline Protestant churches. Soon after the move to Durham, Anne, Howard Wass's wife, had yet another a very severe breakdown and had to be hospitalized. And he looked back on that in hindsight and saw that, you know, she had had a break when they initially had gone to Notre Dame, and now moving to another community. I'm sure a change like that to someone who has severe mental problems can be disconcerting. So she has a major psychotic break right after he arrives in Durham. It seems that as his academic and professional career were rising, his personal life and Anne's condition were crumbling and deteriorating. After Howard Wass's son, Adam, left for college, there were more disturbing things that happened within the household. Anne told Howard Wass that she wanted to leave him, and she wanted to go back to South Bend, where she planned to pursue one of Howard Wass's former colleagues, with whom she delusionally fantasized that she had a relationship that was non-existent in reality. He allowed her to go, and She set up an apartment and lived in South Bend then for the rest of her life apart from him. Harawas got a legal separation agreement from Anne, and he describes a really very sad portion of the memoir. He describes getting a call from her brother, and the brother tells him that Anne has tried to commit suicide. She took a knife and stabbed herself in the chest with it and probably would have bled to death had the knife blade not broken off in her chest. And this is on page 203 in the memoir. Really a turning point. Harawas says that he answers his brother-in-law and says simply, "I am not coming." And he makes the break with his wife. Eventually, he does go on to get a legal divorce from her. And he says that despite all of the trouble that she had brought him, he did insist on giving her a very generous alimony, which he continued to pay until she died. Again, and we'll come back to this in a moment, reflecting on this part of the story. But let me go on to say that soon after Anne left, Harawas had been in counseling. He and Anne had both been talking to a counselor. She left. He continued to talk with the counselor, and before the separation agreement, divorce was even signed, the counselor encouraged him to begin looking around to find someone else to be with. He was lonely. And so he began dating a woman, Paula Gilbert, who was then the director of admissions at the Divinity School at Duke. She had a PhD in church history and was serving there as the director of admissions. She was more than 10 years his junior, and she was an ordained Methodist, or is an ordained Methodist minister. You know, again, coming from a traditional conservative Christian perspective, it's a different kind of memoir to read. There's one line in particular I wrote down. It's page 202 in the memoir, where this is something you'd only read in the memoir of a liberal theologian. He says, quote, "Of course, I was still officially married. I realized that dating Paula might offend some people in the divinity school," end quote. Interesting statement. He realized that dating a woman while he's still married to someone else might possibly cause offense in the divinity school. Sometime after the official divorce, Anne Harawas records would die of congestive heart failure in her late 50s. She apparently died isolated and alone. It took several days, and her body had decomposed before someone found her in her apartment in South Bend. Her mother had also died in her late 50s. Her mother had suffered with mental problems. At any rate, Harawas had gone on with his life. In 1989, he had married Paula Gilbert and begun a new life, and his academic career continued to prosper. He was increasingly in demand as an author and a speaker, particularly in mainline liberal Protestant churches. Although he was known for his critiques and criticisms of liberal mainline churches along the lines of the things he had written in Resident Aliens, nevertheless, he was invited to give various prestigious lectureships, many of which became books. In 2001, he was invited to give the very prestigious Gifford Lectures at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland on natural theology, and this became the book With the Grain of the Universe. There were also times for continuing academic politics, with a change of deans at Duke. And one of the interesting aspects of the memoir, too, is he describes how he became personally involved in a disciplinary process for his intellectual mentor, John Howard Yoder. If you know anything about Yoder, he wrote a book called The Politics of Jesus. Again, had a big influence on Harawas and others. But it was discovered late in his life that he had serially abused, act inappropriately toward a number of women, particularly women in the Mennonite church, and he was confronted with this. And Hauerwas and some other people, including Glenn Stassen, were called in, and they helped mediate his reconciliation back into his Mennonite church, and then he died soon after that. Hauerwas and his new wife Paula became part of a struggling Methodist church in Durham, Aldersgate Methodist, and they stuck with that. Had a woman minister who eventually had Alzheimer's. She was replaced by a young woman minister who was a Duke Divinity grad, and she attempted to introduce Willow Creek Innovations into this little church and try to help it to grow. And Hauerwas describes meeting with her, and he decides that it's time for them to leave. And it's interesting, you know, church conflicts come in all varieties. You have a liberal church, have a woman minister, and you can have a conflict over Willow Creek Innovations. So it's kind of bizarre. But as of the writing of the memoir, 2010, Hauerwas and his wife had left Aldersgate, and they had become part of a more liturgical Episcopalian church. So he had, although he's probably the leading public Methodist theologian, he had gone to an Episcopalian church. Well, that's the sketch, basically. That's a sketch of the memoir. Obviously not exhaustive, but hopefully you get the gist of it. Now I want to turn and I want to offer some reflections on the theology and also on the ethics that are demonstrated in this memoir and in Hauerwas' work. So the first thing I want to look at is, what is the significance of Stanley Hauerwas and his theology? As he comes to the sunset of his life and career, Hauerwas is still highly respected in academic and liberal Protestant and even Roman Catholic church circles for his views on narrative theology, what is something that's called pastoral theology, for his pacifism. So he still is very much respected in demand as a speaker in those circles for his work in those areas. If you listen to Stanley Hauerwas on YouTube, and there are a number of lectures where you can listen to him speaking, or if you read the memoir, you do get the sense that he rather enjoys the position of being sort of an unconventional theologian. You know, there are those people who they enjoy being cantankerous, you know, theologian, or someone who takes the opposite to the majority. He likes being radical, and this is another thing that he does that he writes about in the memoir, and at least he's self-aware. And if you listen to many of his lectures online, you hear this as well. He enjoys sometimes just throwing out some foul language, sort of to shock his audience. You know, ministers aren't supposed to say, you know, use curse words, and so he'll throw out a curse word or something like that. And he'll also say things to sort of offend, I think, his typical audience, the mainline audience. And I was listening to one lecture, and it was actually pretty funny. He was talking about how banal a lot of sermons are in mainline Protestant churches, and he says, if I hear a minister start to talk about what he's learned from his 12-year-old son this week, he says, I know that what is about to come is a bunch of BS. Of course, he doesn't use the abbreviation. But, he, you know, he's sort of that person who can tweak the mainline Protestants because he is one of them. Hauerwas is not what we would call a systematic theologian. I've not read his works extensively. I've just read a couple of his books. I've read Resident Alien and After Christendom. And some others, but he didn't write a systematic theology. He doesn't seem to have much interest in a systematic approach to theology. I think he would see that as passé, as you know, back in the Middle Ages. He did not write any one particular work that could be called his magnum opus. He admits that most of his books are simply collections of essays. He would say he's really an essayist rather than a systematic theologian. Of course, from a conservative, traditional, what he would probably call a fundamentalist Christian perspective, my perspective, the main problem with Hauerwas theologically seems that he doesn't appear to be very interested in building his theology on the exegetical study of Scripture. He wants to build his theology more on philosophy, more on assessing various theologians and thinkers, as opposed to basing it on exegetical work with the Scriptures. He doesn't seem to address much in the memoir his facility with biblical languages, or deep study of the Scriptures, or even references to the Scriptures. He jokes at one point in the book that he had not really read much of the Bible until he started teaching some of the basic Bible courses when he was teaching at Augustana and at Notre Dame. Although, to his credit, he does speak about having a growing appreciation for the Bible and for listening to preaching later in his life. But there's just, in this memoir at least, there's very little discussion of biblical interpretation. He doesn't talk about reading the Bible to come to his beliefs about pacifism. He doesn't talk about the Sermon on the Mount. He doesn't talk about, you know, Romans 13, how he interprets that. So he doesn't talk about biblical support or biblical challenges to his position. And again, I know it's not a theological work, but it's a memoir, but it's just not on the radar screen. And I think in particular, he doesn't talk about biblical categories when it comes to his ethics, and in particular, how he dealt personally with the severe problems he had in his marriage and his family. He doesn't talk about the impact of Genesis 2 and the one flesh union that a marriage is, or what Jesus taught about marriage in places like Matthew 19, what God has put together, let no man put asunder. He doesn't describe or interact with Paul's teaching on marriage in 1 Corinthians 7. And so there's not a lot of exegetical interaction. And this is also becomes problematic for his ecclesiology, for his doctrine of the church. He literally is all over the map ecclesiologically. He grows up as a Methodist. He teaches at a Lutheran school. When he's at Notre Dame, he attends Catholic Mass. He is influenced by a Mennonite theologian. He goes back to being a Methodist. Then he becomes an Episcopalian. He thinks of this as being, you know, positive. He is a real ecumenist. But it might also be interpreted as a not so positively as a lack of firm understanding and commitment to the beliefs and practices represented by a particular tradition. And many of those traditions are mutually exclusive. You can't really be a Catholic and a Protestant. You can't really be a Calvinist and Arminian. And surely a theologian should be able to articulate the wide differences between these various groups. And yet, Hauerwas doesn't really do that. And he, in that sense, he's a very postmodern, very relativistic type thinker. Hauerwas' theology also seems to be nearly completely disengaged from confessional Christianity. Although I suspect he would affirm the ecumenical creeds. He doesn't have any discussion of the Reformed or Protestant creeds, even Methodist or Episcopalian Anglican creeds. And I think this leads again to a lot of contradictions. In addition to the lacking biblical foundations, he also lacks confessional foundations. So he is a neo-Orthodox Bartian, but he's also a Methodist. He's a Paedo-Baptist, but he's also an Anabaptist. And again, he would see this as positive. He's holding these tensions together, but I certainly see that as a weakness. His lack of traditional definitions also leads him to be unwilling to identify what it means to be a Christian. Of course, he puts this forward at the very beginning of the book, that he never became a Christian at Pleasant Mound Methodist Church. He talks about, you know, he went to divinity school, he wasn't really sure he was a Christian, and so forth. He's even teaching theology, and he's not sure he's a Christian, although later he begins to think of himself as a Christian theologian. In particular, he begins to think of himself as a theologian of the church. But again, he never defines what it means to be a Christian. Is it baptism that makes one a Christian? Is it church membership? Dismisses at the beginning of the memoir, is it regeneration? Is it being converted? Is it repenting of your sins and having faith in the Lord Jesus Christ? And of course, traditional Christian perspective, Protestant evangelical perspective, Reformed perspective, we would say that is what makes one a Christian. It's conversion. Harwas is dismissive of those who stress creedal and the confessional aspects of Christianity. We'll talk about how it's not a matter of what you believe. And he'll, I think, try to dress that up in a sort of Bardian, you know, sovereignty. God is sovereign. It doesn't matter what you believe about him sort of perspective. But again, he doesn't interact, I think, with the exegetical approach to Scripture, which lays out through Revelation what it does mean to be a believer. And he never offers any alternatives to that. He lacks boundaries. He lacks clarity in his thinking, despite, you know, being so well respected and so prestigious. So, I mean, he appeals, I think, to sort of the spirit of this age. With regard to worship, Harwas likes to describe himself as a, quote, high church Mennonite, end quote. And I think that means he likes liturgical worship and he likes the simplicity of the Anabaptists. At least positive thing is he does seem to speak highly about the value of sort of a basic word and sacrament ministry. That's why he didn't like the Willow Creek sort of stuff. As the memoir indicates, toward the end of his life and career, he does come to appreciate going to church. He never uses sort of traditional confessional language, the beans of grace, but he does talk about, you know, going to church a lot. And in particular, he talks about enjoying watching his wife celebrate. That's the verb that's used over and over again. He enjoys watching his wife celebrate the Eucharist. I guess that means lead in serving the Eucharist. Again, though, he can offer no authoritative reasons for his preferences in worship or ecclesiology beyond his personal preferences. This is what he likes. This is what he doesn't like. So there's no sense of the regulative principle of worship. There's no sense of Scripture regulating what's appropriate in worship. And that's the reason you should worship in this way and not in another way. And in that sense, because he doesn't have the guidance of Scripture, he doesn't reflect on the fact that, for example, Scripture teaches that women should not serve as elders, or they should not lead in public worship, or they should not be authoritative doctrinal teachers. And he never talks about what the scriptural guidelines are for ministers, for elders, and so forth. So again, there's a lot of confusion, lack of clarity, lack of authority in his theology. Finally, let me address some of the issues that relate to Stanley Hauerwas's practice of and view of ethics. Now, this is Hauerwas's memoir, and he admits several times throughout the book that, you know, he's telling his story, he's telling it from his perspective, and he even sort of indicates sort of a Brian Williams-esque that he might not always be remembering everything exactly accurately. The central issue in the memoir, the central personal event in Hauerwas's life that he goes back to again and again and again is his marriage to Anne and the failure of that marriage. Of course, we never get to hear directly from Anne. All we hear are Hauerwas's perspective, and there's very, very, very little positive that's ever said about Anne. There are a lot of negative things that are said about her, and I don't want to stand in judgment of Hauerwas. The Lord alone is the judge of all the earth. He's my judge, and he's Hauerwas' judge. He's all our judge. And I wouldn't be talking about this if he hadn't written publicly, you know, in his memoir about his marriage. But since he's written about it, you know, I have to think about what he said. I certainly wouldn't want all my thoughts and actions brought under public scrutiny, because I'm a sinner saved by grace and fall short of his glory daily and have to engage in habitual repentance. But this part of his memoir, the marriage with Anne, is certainly the part that I found most troubling. I'm not sure, you know, everything that was said about her, we've no way to gauge it. I mean, she must have had moments when she was functioning okay. She did raise their son while he spent most of the day away teaching. And I'm sure you don't produce the kind of output that he's produced academically without spending lots of time in the study. And so all the time they were at Notre Dame over those 14 years, the 6 years in graduate school, the 2 years in doing college teaching, and she was there in his life for a long time, and she was taking care of his son while he was building his career. And again, it's a tragic, sad situation. It's a reminder of sin, of depravity, and so forth. But I'm troubled that when he discusses his divorce from Anne, he never mentions again any biblical justification for this move. And he might have marshaled some biblical justifications, because according to his story, she deserted him. She you could even say committed adultery through these fantasized relationships with his colleagues and so forth. But when he talks about the end of his marriage, the decision seems to be based primarily in his personal feelings and experience. This is justified because she did these irrational things, and she was mean to me, and she didn't support me, and she was cruel to my son, and so forth. And so it seems to be all based on that rather than on any biblical justification. One of the lectures I listened to on YouTube of Hauerwas is one in which he attacked Fletcher's situation ethics, which was popular back in the 60s and 70s. Although he would dismiss situation ethics, his discussion of his divorce from his wife has a very utilitarian tone to it. He did what was best for him. He went to counseling, and he seemed to justify it by, look, I went to counseling. This is what the counselor suggested. But I can't help thinking, you know, if Stanley Hauerwas is influenced by the Anabaptists, for example, I wonder if he ever talked to any of them. Because my understanding is that the Anabaptists have very strong views on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. I don't know what John Howard Yoder's views were. I know I've read a Mennonite theologian, John Koblenz, and they seem to be very much against entertaining any idea of divorce or remarriage. Even Yoder's wife, after Yoder had committed these abuses against various women, Yoder's wife stood by him. And so I wonder, again, if Hauerwas is being completely consistent in living out his ethics. I know as a pastor, I've sometimes had to give counsel to husbands who have to live with difficult wives, and I've also talked to wives who have to live with difficult husbands. I do marriage counseling on a regular basis with young people. And one of the questions that I usually ask if I'm doing premarital counseling, particularly the man, I ask him, Let's suppose that you get married and you've got this usually, you know, beautiful young woman you're about to marry. But let's suppose a year after the wedding, your wife is in a terrible automobile accident and she is severely injured. Her spinal cord is injured and she's going to be paralyzed for the rest of her life. She is going to be completely dependent upon you for everything. She will not be able to do all the things that you were expecting her to do. She won't be able to help you in care and management for the house. If you have children, she's not going to be able to help you manage your child. She's not going to be able to be intimate with you. And then I asked them, well, what would you do if that happened? And, you know, will you remain faithful to her? Will you remain married to her? And, of course, the answer that I'm looking for to come back from that man is, I will remain committed to her as my wife till death parts us. I am going to be committed to my wife. And I think, you know, after reading this memoir, I might alter that question perhaps in some future counseling sessions and ask, you know, something like, what if 5 years into the marriage, your wife has a psychotic break and she is abusive toward you? She curses you out. The two of you cannot function in a healthy way as companions, and she can't be a helpmeet to you. What do you do? And I'm hoping the answer that I would get back from a young Christian man entering into marriage is, I will be committed to my wife, and I will do so because Christ is committed to me despite the flagrancy of my sin, despite my ongoing sanctification and the places where I stumble and fall, that Christ is not going to break or sever his relationship to his bride, the church. And so I, as a man, am not going to break or sever my union with my wife. In the end, I think there are a lot of things we can learn from Stanley Hauerwas and his personal story. We can admire his work ethic. We can admire things like his ability to network, connect, make friends, etc. But we could also see some warnings in his story. I think warnings about where the road leads when there's a lack of exegetical biblical foundations for the faith, when there's a lack of confessional boundaries for the faith, even a lack of ecclesiological boundaries. And so then the way that plays out in personal ethics. So anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this review, response, reaction to Stanley Hauerwas's book, and look forward to talking with you later on a future episode of Word Magazine. Take care, and God bless.
Now I feed on tears from weeping, while they say, is your God sleeping? All these things I call to memory, and I ponder in my heart, how with throngs I moved rejoicing to his temple's sacred court. Why my soul be in despair, why this worry and this care? Hope in God, my soul's salvation, him I'll praise with jubilation. When my heart despairs within me, then will I recall once more, as the headwaters of Jordan from the Mount of Hermon pour. Deep to deep roars out its sound, waves in rapids surging round. In the day God's love comes freely, and at night his song is with me. To my God, my rock, I murmur, how could you forget me? How? All my foes oppress and taunt me, where's your God, they ask me now. Why my soul be in despair, why this worry and this care? Hope in God, my soul's salvation, Him I'll praise with jubilation.